Hey, this is Jeremy Vine.
Hi, I'm Yannis Varoufakis.
Hi, I'm Paul Mason, and you're listening to this special relationship podcast. I don't know what's going to come next, but I hope it's good.
We're not gonna Brexit. No, we ain't gonna Brexit. We're not gonna Brexit anymore.
Welcome back to another episode of The Special Relationship. As you may or may not have guessed from that wonderful introduction music that we recorded down in Westminster just a couple of weeks ago, this podcast is going to be on the future of the European Union.
Yeah, so with the Brexit situation and Gilets Jaunes in France and some other really kind of crazy mobilizations that are going on around the European Union, we're kind of just going to take a step back and consider the state of the European Union project today and why it has some of these issues that it does, with a particular focus on kind of the financial and political integration and then whether there's an imbalance between the two. And then secondly, we're going to go into possible ideas to reform and ways in which we can move past this nation-state identity and reconsider kind of a new form of political identity with Europe as a whole. And then finally, we're going to end with some institutional barriers to reform and how we might be able to move past them. But we're going to begin with a conversation that Freddie had with the journalist Paul Mason on whether or not the European Union can be reformed.
What I would say is that if we get a second referendum and we win it for a Remain, then the first thing that a Labour government would have to do is to say, we want to reform Europe positively. We want a left commissioner. We want to change the Lisbon Treaty. Here are our asks. We are the second biggest economy. That's what I would do. It wouldn't be that revolutionary to start with, but it would change the direction. It would give everybody left wing in the EU a pole of attraction. So these parties on 10 and 20% would then, they would see a government in favour of left policy and a left ethos. But it's not going to be easy. The whole of the European Union, I don't think, is that reformable, but you can do a bit.
Okay, that was Paul Mason giving us his view on Brexit and the European Union from the left in Britain.
Yeah, and to understand and unpack a little bit more of the European Union, we are joined by Timo Stibbe, who is part of the Advanced Master of European Politics and Policies program at KU Leuven and Sciences Po Paris. He specializes in European integration theory, and his current thesis focuses on the future of European institutional reform. Welcome, Timo.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So recently, both Timo and Freddie wrote articles on The Junction about the European Union. And I guess I thought that we would kind of jump right in and just kind of ask both, how do you envisage the future of the European Union, short-term or long-term? Timo, we can start with you.
The way I see it is that at the moment, the EU, because it sort of stopped integrating at the moment, it's, to me, it's sort of a very unbalanced organization, where on the one hand, you have financial integration, but financial integration, you need, you know, social policies, you need fiscal policies, you need social protection, you need, if you have a monetary union, needs politics for that. So, you know, if you have this monetary integration, you need these other things as well at some point. And I think that was always the plan of European integration. They started out as a financial framework, and then the initiative, which they also expressed in like the Rome Treaty and earlier treaties, is that they would steadily work towards more social policies and more social integration and integration on all these other, in all these other areas. And most of the literature says there are two reasons for why that doesn't happen anymore and where it sort of stopped happening is, in the first place, in the 70s of the last century, where you had the oil crisis in Europe, which caused many, many governments, starting in England, to reform their public services and public policy areas to a private sector way of doing, organizing public services, which as a consequence had that they cut a lot of spending on their welfare state. So the welfare states, instead of being orientated towards a grander European level, which went quite well until the 70s, they focused on their national policies and they sort of turned inward. So that's like the first major sort of bump in the road towards more integration in those areas. The second one being the enlargement of the more recent enlargement of member states. where you had these countries that were on a whole other level than the other welfare states that the European Union already had. So those two bumps in the road of integration made it sort of stop evolving to a more comprehensive, integrated union that they were envisioning. So that is where it sort of stopped. So what you have now at the moment is a union that does have financial integration, but does not have these other integrational forms that it really, really requires. So it's not political enough, it's not social enough, it's not organized.
To talk a little bit about, you know, what Timo was saying there, I would 100% agree with, you know, his analysis in that the European Union at the moment is, you know, to use the phrase he used in his column, weathering some heavy storms. It's you know, you can see all the way across Europe, you know, you have, you know, riots in the streets in Belgrade and Budapest, and you have, you know, this mayor being killed in Gdansk in Poland, with far-right immigration parties being in control, and you have the Yellow Vest protests in France that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. You have, you know, fascist politicians in Austria and in Italy. You know, Euroscepticism is all the way across the continent at the moment. So if you're asking me how I vision the future of the European Union, short and long term, I'd say short term we have MEP elections in May, and it's quite likely that we're going to see some heavy anti-EU backlash in those. And longer term, Timo's totally right in the sense that we've had financialization of EU markets and economic integration with these four freedoms. And we haven't at the same time had the regulatory oversight or democratic accountability to be able to deal with the problems of inequality that financialization has created. So I would 100% agree with Timo's analysis of that. The next question then is, how do we deal with that? And then do we think that it's possible to deal with that, firstly, within the boundaries of the current union and the laws? And secondly, do we feel like the current retreat into the nation state makes it impossible for us to put the reforms of political integration to the people of Europe in the next 10 to 15 years?
Timo, do you think that kind of institutional reform is possible within the current structures of the European Union?
Yeah, so this is a difficult question because I think the only way to solve the issues that we just talked about is by streamlining these issues to the central level. In my opinion, that's the only way forward. That's the only thing that we can do. But the difficulty herein is that, of course, we have now this sort of mindset of anti-EU and very nationalistic thinking in many countries. So the question really is, how do we change the mindset? How do we change the sentiments from being too national to, you know, making transnational thinking positive or popular again? But we definitely have to do that because the only way to solve the inequalities in the European Union is by making it an equal system, which can only happen on the central level. You can only organize fiscal policies, social policies, things like that. You can only do that on the central European level.
By a central level, do you mean just like an enhanced kind of European Parliament, or more power to the Parliament and the Commission?
Yeah, so what I mean by that is making the EU a more state-like organization. So it can either be a federal state, it can be a republican idea, it can be like however you want to organize it, but that would imply that you have an executive which could be the Commission. You would have a normal functioning parliament, which we don't have at the moment. But the most important aspect of that is that parliament should have executive powers as well. They should have the right of initiative, which they lack at the moment, which means they cannot make laws at the moment, which is not really a normal situation for parliament. So the only democratic institution in the European Union doesn't have the powers that it needs to, you know, execute its democratic powers. So you would have to shift powers around within the institutions. You have to make it more state-like organization in order to make it more democratic, but that's definitely what it needs, to make it more political, and so it can tackle the issues that cause inequality among member states at the moment.
And that's kind of an interesting point, and one that, Freddie, you raise in your article as well, in looking at the DiEM movement, kind of movements that are trying to make the European Union more political, trying to address these issues of transparency and accountability and democracy. Do you agree with kind of Timo's assessment on what needs to be done in that sense? And how do you view kind of what DiEM is doing or some other kind of tangible policy proposals that are on the table right now?
Yeah, so to answer what Timo is saying, if you are going to make the EU more political, you also have to make it more democratic. And I think that's, you know, as Timo said in his column, that is one of the things that people take most, you know, take umbrage with at the European level at the moment. And a lot of the reasons why people across, or politicians, far right politicians across the continent, can sort of scapegoat the European Union is to say, look at these, you know, look at this institution or these institutions that are taking away your sovereignty. You're not democratically electing them. I think Timo's right to say that we need politics on the European level to deal with particular issues. I think it needs to be politics based on localism. And I think what I mean by this is, at any given level, like we have, you know, in different nation states, you will have, you know, your local constituency will be in charge of the local problems that it can best run and solve because it knows it has the information best at hand. And, you know, then you have your higher up level, your national level, which directs national policy, which trickles down to those particular local areas. I think the same can be applied, transposed onto this international stage. Obviously, like we talked about, we need international coordination. We're going to fairly redistribute wealth across the European Union and beyond. We're going to need international coordination to rebalance the current battle between labor and capital. If you're going to do that and have politics that does that, it's very important, as you say, Aaron, that it is democratic politics, and it's also important that it's transparent. And, you know, DiEM, as I mentioned in my article, have a couple of very short-term easy things that they want to implement. Things like, you know, live streaming meetings, European Council, Finance Affairs Council, Eurogroup meetings, you know, publishing the minutes of the European Central Bank, things like registering lobbyists, listing meetings and donations. I think these are very easy, transparent things to do that will have two very important effects. One, you get accountability on the international level. You get, you know, European bureaucrats accountable to people that are watching them all the way across Europe who can see their decision making. And hopefully then you get realignment of interest with the European demos. And two, you get engagement. I think this is really important to what you were saying before, is that, you know, people can actively engage with European politics if they see it, if they have access to it. And that might make them more in favor of aligning or further integration, political integration, to deal with these issues. So I think that is those are the basic things that DiEM outlines, and I think that they are very easy, straightforward, and positive steps to take.
Yeah, so I think this comes down to kind of a question of identity and also just culture. While the European Union does provide a nice prototype for how to deal with these global problems and kind of move beyond the nation state, there are still very strong national identities that are ingrained within the cultures that compose the European Union. And I guess, Timo, do you see that as feasible? Do you see it as feasible for a political party to kind of be voted in transnationally and go beyond the particular kind of nation state boundaries that are so strong right now?
Yeah, so I think if we're talking about a transnational organization, and it doesn't mean that we have to give up our particularities or the things that people identify themselves with within the context of their nation state. As Freddie mentioned, I think the only feasible organization that you can have on such a, you know, large level is have a central government that organizes everything that is important to organize at the central level. So, say, fiscal policies. But then, you know, the closer the government is to the people, the better it is, I would argue. So that means you would still have either states in a federal system or, for instance, regions, autonomous regions that more or less cover what the states nowadays, the member states, cover at the moment, where the sort of local policies can be designed. So I completely agree with that, just in relation to what Freddie just said. So I think organizing something on a European level doesn't have to be an infringement on national identity. And what I also wanted to stress is that the EU does not need a European identity. I think it's very, very hard to argue that there is a European identity. I mean, for certain people, there definitely is. For me, for instance, I do feel European, but it will never be the same as on a national level because you lack certain ingredients on the European level that are present on a national level. And you can talk, you know, for instance, language or things like that. So I think it's important to realize that the EU does not need a European identity. What it does need is a common ground on which people can start to feel, you know, closer together. They can feel solidarity. That's also what I talk about in my column. We don't need identity. We need solidarity, a willingness for people to work together despite their differences. And the basis that I'm talking about could be a constitution. So I really think we need a European constitution to sort of base our norms and values on that can then be recognized by European citizens. And that's also what DM talks about, which I think is a very good idea, is to have, you know, these platforms or centers where the people of Europe can come together in a way to design this constitution, which they can all feel related to. And when you have this constitution, which then outlines the norms and values that we want to base European democracy on, you can have a community. And it doesn't need to be based on identity, but it can be based on solidarity.
Yeah, I think that's really kind of, I think it's an interesting point, because if we call for the European Union to kind of have a greater sense of centrality or an executive power, it can kind of fall into the same problems that a nation state has, where it develops a notion of kind of Western exceptionalism and kind of scapegoating even some of your problems onto the other. So kind of challenging this notion of identity, even thinking maybe in terms of more of a global citizenship, rather even beyond just European, could be a step forward in that.
You know, the one major problem I see with nation states is that national identities are always based on, you know, what makes us unique and what makes us different from others. It is what they, like a small group of people, have in common vis-a-vis the other people. And I think when you base something on norms and values instead of these constructed identities, which they are, you avoid the risk of making a Europe which is differentiated itself from other parts of the world, saying, okay, this makes us European, or this is our European identity. That would have the same problematic texture as national identities, where they say, no, we as a people are different from that people. Like, that's not what we want. In theory, I think what we should strive for is having a community which potentially could always grow, like for every country that recognizes the norms and values and the constitutional basis of the community could in theory join this community. I think that's extremely important, which then would open up the door, you know, to future organizations of communities all around the world, because it's not based anymore on where we come from, what language we speak, which histories we have, which people we are, which ethnicities we encompass. You know, those are things that are limiting and in my view, very negative.
Yeah, can I jump in? Can I jump in there, if that's all right?
Yeah.
I'd like to just pick up on Timo's point that he's making there. And I think it's really, you know, important that he stresses these things about common identity. You know, halfway through the 18th century, only 35% of the US spoke English. And, you know, that demos was created over time through political and social, you know, amalgamations. This sort of thing is actively possible. And there's lots of precedents to demonstrate that it is possible. I want to make very clear where I stand on this point of view, is that I think that the European Union has been actively complicit in its own contradictions in the way in which it brings people together. And, you know, I mentioned in my column on talking about the financial crisis and being like, look, this is a wider problem of neoliberal capitalism with this cyclical process of crisis. But the European Union, the way in which it's designed, actively brought in policies of austerity and enforced those policies on countries like Greece, transferring the burden of the financial crisis of 2008 onto the weakest members of our societies, I think really fostered and harbored these divisions and this retreat into the nation state. So I think it's all very well people coming out and saying, look, we need to persuade people that, you know, what's different isn't what matters and it's what makes people the same. These things are really lovely ideas, but they have to be put into practice in practical policymaking terms. And I think the European Union, the way in which it's run at the moment, actively divides people in the way in which it's pushing people to extremes.
Yeah, how would you... So while you hold those views, you've come out against kind of Brexit and even Lexit from that argument. And what do you... Why do you think it's better to remain in the European Union in that sense than kind of retreating into your own nation state and kind of dealing with these inequalities on that level?
Well, look, in the article, there are two reasons why I think this idea of a left-wing Brexit is not feasible or not the way that we should be looking to move forward. Firstly, I talk about the idea of global warming, the fact that the IPCC report came out in October detailing that we need to cut 45% of global carbon emissions by 2030. We need a complete transition to clean energy by 2050 or 2055. These things are, as we said in our podcast last week, Aaron, are going to take international cohesion. They're going to take people sitting down together and working out how we're going to put pressure on those 100 companies that produce 71% of our carbon emissions. And for me, that takes joint policy and it takes international coordination. And whilst the European Union has many flaws that I outlined in my column, the European Parliament is one of the most exceptional prototypes for international democracy. I mean, if you look around at other international institutions that were created in the second half of the 20th century, you have things like the IMF, you have the World Bank. I mean, these things are fundamentally, whereas they may look like they have this facade of democracy, are heavily controlled by the lobbying and the veto powers of the United States. And similarly with the United Nations Security Council, you have, heavy veto powers from particular countries. So if you look at the European Parliament as this like democratic model, I think, and I'm sure Timo will agree with me when I say this, it is a fantastic prototype to be moving forward with. The problem with the rest of the European Union is the institution, as Timo was saying before, the Commission, the executive, which is unelected at the moment, has the power to, as a monopoly on power, on initiating legislation to the Parliament. And so you're restricting the power of democracy to make social change.
How do you view this kind of post-Brexit European Union? I know that you're kind of looking at looking at the European Parliament elections that are going to occur in May, and you're kind of looking at some of the platforms that the major parties are running on. Do you see any? I know that we've discussed DiEM, but they're not part of the European Parliament right now. They're not. They haven't actually been elected yet. Do you see any kind of interesting policy proposals from more of the establishment parties on how to transform this European Union, assuming that they also agree that it's really facing some crisis points right now?
The problem is, and like I was saying before, is because the European Commission has the monopoly on initiating legislation to the Parliament, you need a commissioner and his bureaucrats that he has around him in the Commission to put forward a radical agenda if you agree that you need to transition the entire economy of the European Union from what we have at the moment to this more sort of human-centric, eco-centric economy. So if you're going to initiate things like Timo's talking about, like further integration of the political realm and further democracy, transparency, you need to have someone in the Commission that is going to push forward radical legislation. Because the way in which the European Union is designed at the moment, the Parliament cannot, even if you vote in a whole load of social and democratic MEPs, it's not going to have the ability to transform the European Union from the inside. You need a radical left commissioner. The Spitzenkandidat has to be someone who is willing to push forward radical change. And the way in which the European Union is designed at the moment, it seems very unlikely that that's going to be the case.
If I can react to that, I think that's very true. And again, what I said earlier, the important thing now, and I think the European elections of May 2019 are an excellent momentum for that, is to reset the mindset and the discourse about Europe a bit. For instance, if I tell people that I study European politics, they usually laugh and say, oh, well, that must be very interesting. Or on, like, you know, using a tone in implicating that it's all chaos and unstructured, you know, organization, etc. So if we manage to, or if new groups and new people such as DiEM25 manage to get popular support in the EU and really make new fresh plans for the EU popular with European citizens, I think that's the start that we need to go towards these other changes and reforms that we talked about, which, like Freddie said, are now very, very, very unlikely to happen.
Yeah, I think that kind of just fits with the greater narrative of what's going on just globally right now. It's kind of just this discontent with just establishment parties and just the political system in general, which creates a vacuum, which allows kind of these different parties or these different ideas to kind of come up and be taken more seriously than they have in the past.
The problem is fundamentally, you have, as you say, you have these like radical politics that's coming up all over the world that's looking to change things, and you have the same within the European Union. And we talk about DiEM, and you know, Timo, you sent me something on Volt Europa, another one of these young parties that's trying to cross nationally elect MEPs. The problem is that in the European Union, as I said before, it is legally enshrined the four freedoms of movement, as in labor, capital, goods, and services. And if you want to put forward a lot of the policies that are going to be able to deal with the economic crisis in the European Union at the moment, you have to change those, and they are the linchpins of the entire union at the moment. So what I'm waiting to hear is some tangible proposal for how we manage to rewrite those to move forward with a larger scale integrated democratic federal project. Because at the moment, the left Brexit argument is very strong that the European Union cannot be reformed, and things like rebalancing the power between labor and capital, like I mentioned before, with higher taxes, and things like state intervention into the economy that's needed to deal with inequality, is actually impossible under the current EU legislation.
So one thing I think is good to look at from that perspective is that while we've been discussing the European Union very much from kind of a supranational level, it's important to also note how much power the member states have and how much power the individual governments have within these member states. So if you can elect a head of state, maybe that is more on that agenda, Freddie, that you speak of, it might be more conceivable to envision kind of this radical transformation of the European Union. In that sense, electing a head of state rather than kind of looking at this as members of the European Parliament. And you're seeing this right now, like on the right, you're seeing this with governments in Hungary, Poland, Italy, the amount of leverage that they yield within the European Union and within their institutions. So it's conceivable to envision that happening on the left as well, for more progressive platforms.
Yeah.
I think just to add to that, what you say is very true, but fundamentally, I think if we're being honest with ourselves, Germany is the hegemon of Europe. And a lot of the cases, when you look at things like Greece and the enforcement of austerity policies, it was Germany to a large extent that was driving that. So when we talk about individual nation states deciding what happens to the European Union, that is very true. And it's very important to recognize that, because the fact we've got to this point in the first place demonstrates that the collective story that nation states choose to follow has, you know, is able to construct internationalism, and we can alter that structure. Where Germany goes at the next election with Merkel stepping down, whether they get a left or a right leader may end up determining significantly the future of the European project.
But if I can, Freddie, because you mentioned the four freedoms of the European Union and how they are sort of fundamental for the organization of it. The thing that I don't understand and want to ask you is, say that member states transfer competences to the European level to organize, for instance, fiscal policies. Why would you then need to touch on the four freedoms of the European Union? Why would you have to mingle with that? Why would you have to change that?
At the moment, what we have is a system of nation states where you, if you want to increase your taxes, say in this country at the moment, there's a good chance that Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell may take the Labour government into power. And if they want to implement the policies of their 2017 manifesto, then they need to find a way in which they can raise money to do that. And obviously, one of the key ways of doing that would be to raise money for tax through taxes. The problem with that is if you hit a certain level of tax, because the way in which Europe and the entire globalized world of neoliberalism works at the moment is that nation states are set to compete against each other to retain capital within their countries. If you say you're going to raise particular taxes on companies with assets over a certain amount, then companies can hold governments to ransom by threatening to leave. And relocate their capital. So what you get if you can do this on the European level, I mean, the Lexic argument, just briefly, would be that, you know, if we break away from the European Union, break away from this freedom of capital, one of the four freedoms, as you say, if you break away from that, then you can institute as legal policy, capital controls, so that if you raise the taxes in this country, then capital won't be able to escape. I don't think that's a viable routes to take for a number of reasons that I laid out in my column and I won't bore you with again. But I think if you do this on an international level, what you do is you can create international coordination to stop capital holding governments to ransom over where they're going to locate their bases. And just to explain why I think that's a better idea on the supranational EU level rather than on the national level, is that the EU is a huge, huge market, which means that if it's politically organized, it has much more power in saying to companies, if you do not abide by our laws, if you do not abide by our rules and taxation policies, then you cannot have access to our markets. And that is a very powerful thing that we'll be able to do if we can, you know, remove this sort of freedom of capital, because, you know, that's with that in place at the moment, you create this ability for capital to be prioritized over labor.
From just bringing a U.S. perspective here, it's something that the European Union has done particularly good at are its regulatory mechanisms, especially in kind of targeting data protection and big tech. So I think that the European Union kind of does provide, while it's going to take some serious barriers, it provides some of the mechanisms that are good for keeping in control some of these regulations.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And as you say, we've had data protection, ecological awareness, you know, like internal free movement of people. The EU has managed to achieve really positive things. This, for me, is a whole nother level, because the way in which the European institutions are set up at the moment, with the Commission and the Council being sort of technocratic, you get lobbyist involvement quite heavily within those two institutions, which hold the majority of the power of the union. If you can, as I was saying before, democratize that, give it accountability, transparency, and increase the power of the European Parliament, or even just have a democratically elected executive, then what you do is you get it. It's much more likely that you're going to be able to institute these kind of reforms in the manner which we've seen reforms in other areas like ecological awareness, et cetera, et cetera. But this at the moment is specifically counter to the interests of the European Commission and the European Council and the European Central Bank.
All right. Well, I think that just about wraps it up. I know that we still have a lot to discuss and a lot of unanswered questions, but hopefully from this podcast, you got a little bit of a clear understanding of some of the problems that the EU is facing and potential ways that it can be sorted out. And thank you so much for joining us, Timo.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this week's episode of the Special Relationship Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please make sure you subscribe on iTunes. And you can also find us on Twitter at TweetTheJunk.
That's Junk with a C.